Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Are you glad?
Yeah, I am
Okay.
glad.
Good.
What are you trying to say?
Nothing. Nothing.
There's craziness at the house right now.
I hear it.
Yeah, everyone is getting ready to go outside and play in the little bit of snow that's still in the backyard.
Is there chaos because of the time change?
No, more so just because they're all getting all of their snow equipment on right in the hallway.
I know kids are kind of like werewolves and stuff.
Yes.
Where the time and stuff like that throws them off.
Yeah, well, they got up at the same time as they always would.
Yeah.
So it was very early. And so Stacy got up with them. I've got Ronnie. It looks like Ronnie is ready, so should I add him?
Yeah, I figured I'd have you initiate for that reason, so since you probably had his info.
Yeah, he just said that he's ready.
Morning.
Ronnie, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Chris, are you still there?
Yep, hi Ronnie. Nice to meet you.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
This is the first time I'm talking to Ronnie on over Skype
Oh, okay.
as
Cool. Well, welcome
well.
to the Retrocast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah. Ronnie, do you when you do your podcast, do you record as well or no?
Yeah, I'm doing a backup record just because.
Oh my God, look at what a professional this guy is.
Yeah, don't even have to
Well,
ask.
I know it's not like he's on eight other
That is
podcasts.
true, yeah.
Yeah, speaking of, in case somebody's listening and doesn't know, do you want to mention some of those shows that you're on, Ronnie?
I do a Doctor Who themed podcast called the Timey Wimey Podcast Hour with my son, and then a friend that I've had since we were kids that we love Doctor Who, so we talk about Doctor Who. I do an Ultimate Marvel podcast with Jack, and we talk everything Marvel, not just comics.
Ronnie, before you continue, I wanted to say I'm behind a little bit, so I just listened to the one where you and Jack talked a little bit about the fresh new start.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and it's not, even Jack is now getting sick of the reboots.
Yeah. And
You know
see,
that it's bad when Mr. Marvel himself is getting annoyed.
yeah, that was the whole theme of that one.
Yeah.
'Cause Jack was all in always about anything Marvel. So he was like the ultimate Marvel fanboy. And then I just read everything. So that way I could put him in check sometimes. And then now it's like we're back on the same page, kind of like he's like, well, I don't know.
It was funny to I'm like, oh my, 'cause I was wondering, I'm like, well, how is Jack gonna sound with this? And he was like feeling it, saying it basically exactly how I felt. I'm like, seriously, what are they doing? But
Yeah,
anyhow,
I'm
sorry,
not
didn't
really
mean to.
current on things, and at first I thought that when I saw something in passing about a fresh start or whatever it's called, I actually thought it was a joke because of
Yeah,
that.
I was hoping it was because, in my opinion, Legacy has been killing it.
Well, it just seems like they're just going, like they don't, to me, and I know we're getting off topic, but it seems like they don't know what they want to do. And so they lean one way, and then 6 months later they lean
Yes.
a 180, they do a 180 and go back. And it's like they just have no, it's like I was saying before, it's like they're rudderless. It's like they have no idea what direction they want to take their line.
Yep, it's like we were saying on that episode, they're like teenage kids with ADHD.
Yeah. So kind of crazy.
Yep, really crazy.
But yeah, so go ahead, tell your other podcasts.
Well, I do Aftershock Central podcast, which with Martin and Travis, and we just do a review of Aftershock books that came out that week or the previous 2 weeks, depending when we can get together. And then Absolute DC, where, again, I do it with Aaron, and we just talk everything DC.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those are all with the Nerdy Legion podcast network, right? Yeah.
Yep, that's correct. Actually, I'm drinking coffee from my Timey Wimey Podcast Hour coffee mug.
Nice. Yeah, I noticed. I haven't listened to that yet, but I noticed that that podcast started, and I was curious about you probably have talked about this on that show, but I was curious about your history with Doctor Who, because I started watching Doctor Who maybe 4 or 5 years ago, so I'm newer to Doctor Who, but have watched quite a lot.
For me, just briefly, because I know we're sidebarring here.
No, that's okay, because actually I think me and Chris are probably both going to kind of ask you some general questions and stuff before we get into anything.
That's cool. For me, I'm almost 40, so when I was in elementary school, old Tom Baker Doctor Who was on.
That's the guy with the scarf?
Correct,
yes. That's the guy that I know, yeah.
He was on PBS all the time, mm-hmm. and so, like, my dad worked nights, so he would be asleep upstairs, and then my mom was getting ready to go to her first job, so my sister and I would have to get to the bus stop by ourselves. Well, watching Tom Baker, Doctor Who on PBS was my, like, alarm. As soon as I seen the credits, then I knew it was time to get to the corner.
That's cool. Yeah.
And so, for the first time on Nerdy Legion, actually, an episode or two ago, I had my wife and my daughter on. So it's the first time that a podcast wife had been on for a whole episode.
Wow.
And we talked about what Doctor Who meant in our house, like, from their perspective. Because I'm a crazy super fan, and they're okay with it, but, you know...
Yeah, I'll have to check that episode out in particular. That'll be interesting to hear. Yeah, that's interesting because I'm around the same age. I'll be 39 in less than a month, and so I also encountered Tom Baker Doctor Who on PBS when I was really little, but for whatever reason, it totally repelled me.
I remember a metal dog.
Yeah. Yep, K-9.
K-9. Yeah. Okay. K-9. Yeah. It seemed like it was just intermittently on, and I never followed it, but I remember seeing that doctor and that metal dog.
Yeah, whatever I saw, I don't think I saw K-9, but I just remember seeing, you know, the dimly lit sets, and I mean, couldn't have articulated that at the time, but something about it really creeped me out, and so... I kept away from it, and, you know, obviously it went off the air, and et cetera, et cetera. And then by the time it came back, obviously I was an adult, and there was enough buzz around the new Doctor Who that I started checking out that. At that point, I think David Tennant was probably already the Doctor, but I just, through streaming, started with the Christopher Eccleston stuff, and that made me curious enough that I went back to the very beginning, and over the last 4 or 5 years, I think, intermittently here and there, I actually watched every single episode of the classic Doctor Who. I finished last year sometime, and I even watched, or you could say listened to, some of the reconstructions of, or all the reconstructions of the missing episodes, and so I'm not totally caught up on everything, because I've only seen maybe like the first episode or two of Capaldi, but I've actually seen everything else. So
yeah,
I did end up digging in pretty deeply.
Wow, there's, I guess so.
It's funny you say that. Like, a couple of our bonus episodes, or basically our bonus episodes, is me and Austin, my son, or Shane and I doing watch-alongs to the old episodes. Mm. So
that would be
like,
fun to listen to, I think.
Kind of like Mystery Science 3000 type thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really fun to do, and unlike doing it over Skype or whatever, it's kind of personable that you can actually do it face-to-face instead of, like, once or twice a year, and it's fun.
Nice. So who's your favorite classic doctor?
My favorite classic doctor is actually John Pertwee, actually.
Okay.
Because he had that Dapper Dan, James Bondish type feel.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I really took to Troughton.
Oh, yeah.
Patrick Troughton. I really found him, something about him really appealed to me. I like they call him the Cosmic Hobo or whatever. I like that.
Right.
I guess, especially because I watched them chronologically coming after the first Doctor, I liked his sort of tendency to play the sort of the buffoon or the silly person, and then kind of have something going on behind the scenes sort of thing.
Right, yep.
So, and I really like the interplay between him and Jamie as a companion. They were a really cool duo. But yeah, I mean, all the classic doctors, I think, have their own individual appeals. So,
cool. Yeah, I think so, for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, definitely have to check out some episodes of your show on that.
Cool. Let me know what you think.
Sure. So, Rob, you said you had some other questions you wanted to...
Yeah, I figured we could grow Ronnie for an hour or two, and then, you know, we'll be done.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, and I remember, Chris, you and Mike asked me some questions when I first joined, and I wanted to kind of ask the same thing, and maybe you've mentioned it in the past, Ronnie, but I don't know that I heard it, but kind of like your comic book origin story, how and when did you first get into comic books, and what were maybe your first comic book or first few comic books? What got you into that collecting thing?
My first comic book, I was probably 11 or 12, and it's kind of how all of it's the same, I guess, how I got into it and then how I got the bug, basically.
Yeah.
Summers, I would go to my aunt and uncle's that's like in a different town, 30, 45 minutes away, and my cousin is around my age, if not a year or two younger, and so I would stay a couple of weeks with him, and they had, it's the town I actually work in now, but, and the LCS is still there, but we'd have to do little chores around the house for my aunt and uncle, and then back then, you know, on Friday they'd give us $5. Well, my uncle was a huge comic book reader as well, and he loved Legion of Superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
So we would deep dive into his boxes and read, and then on Fridays when we got the $5, he would take us to the local comic shop there, and then we would dive into that was back when Secret Wars figures came out. So,
oh yeah, uh-huh.
So like 83, 84, I would say, maybe.
Yep.
And we would deep dive into like nickel and dime and quarter boxes, because you have $5, you can get more. And we would, on Fridays after that, we would walk out with tons of comics, or $5 worth, rather, which is a lot back then, not so much now, but, and my first one was Tales of the Teen Titans number 43.
Oh, wow.
Wow. And, that was your first comic?
Yeah, and I got nice. I got it from the quarter bin. Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, I've kept it to great condition. And then 2 years ago at the con, I was able to have George Perez sign it.
Oh, wow.
So.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then I would say 4 years ago, because back then it was like Power Pack and Teen Titans and Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, or Web of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which a lot of my Web of Spider-Man came from back then. But 2 years ago at our local con in Kansas City, or local-ish to me, I guess, I was able to complete the full run of Web of, so I got to checkmark that.
That's awesome. It's nice to... I recently, in the past like 4 or 5 years, kind of did the same thing where, like, series that I've had pretty much all of but a handful of issues, because, you know, I was started off buying them at like convenience stores actually, and then after that I started going to a comic book shop, so mm-hmm. I was always missing like 3 or 4 or 5 issues. I finally, like, after all of these years, like, completed the runs. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, well, and then after that, of course, I was only there for 2 weeks of the summer, so 2 Fridays, but I'd walk away with like 20 comic books.
Yeah.
But then when I'd come home for the rest of the summer, then I would get them off the spinner rack at the grocery store or medicine shop or whatever.
Yeah. Did you keep buying comic books all the way through, or did you kind of fall away from it and then come back? Or
I was just thinking about that the other day, because I saw a tweet from Mike that said that he never broke away. And I guess technically I never did either, but I only bought 2 books, and that was Batman Proper and Amazing Spider-Man.
Oh,
but I didn't buy anything else. Like, I'd walk into the local comic shop and they'd have the pull box for me for just those 2 or whatever, and I'd grab those and I'd walk out, just because at that time, or a couple of times, I wasn't financially secure like I am now, I guess. But then, like, as soon as I was able to be stable and have an allowance for comics, then, you know, kitty bar the door and I go crazy.
Yeah, I think that definitely counts.
Yeah, for sure. You just paring down and buying what he could afford / what you really wanted, you know? Absolutely. There was a couple times just through school, whether it be middle school or high school, where I would just temporarily lose interest, and it was like 4, 5, 6 months at the very most. And then that, like, kind of like collecting bug would get me again. And also, like, the kind of like obsessive bug where it's like, oh my God, like, now I haven't been buying them for 4 months and I'm now back into it, and I have to go back and get like the four months of issues that I missed.
Yeah.
But so I never, like, I mean, I did stop, but it was never for a long period of time. It was 2 or 3, up to maybe 6 months at the most, and then I'd go back and buy everything that I missed. But yeah, pretty cool.
Which is almost worse, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, like, you know, I was fortunate that when whatever, I think it was 6th or 7th grade, so it would have been like 11 or 12, I got a paper route with two full blocks. So I had, and, you know, as a kid that age, it's like you don't really have any, you obviously don't have expenses or whatever. So I was able to buy a lot more comic books than probably a lot of other kids were at that age. And once I realized that there was a comic book store, which was probably around the same time, my parents used to take me up there every couple weeks or whatever, and I'd buy everything that I was collecting at the time, which, I mean, still wasn't a lot. It might have been like 12 series or something like that, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah, the paper route kids were always the ones that were flush with cash. Seemed like back in the day.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I don't, Chris, do you have anything else for Ronnie?
Yeah, so, well, you said that you asked the question I was going to ask as far as it sounded like that he pretty much stayed in comics, but have you mentioned both DC and Marvel in talking about reading comics growing up. Have you always been someone that's kind of interested in both companies, and when did you kind of venture outside of those companies and stuff? Because, I mean, that's interesting to me because I was pretty much strictly Marvel when I was a kid, and I'm not strictly DC as an adult, but I definitely sort of lean towards DC.
Good question. I would say I pretty much towed the fence as a kid. Mm-hmm. My favorite Marvel character is Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And so, like, I really loved what they were doing there. And then, you know, what they did with Superman. Of course, you know, with the death of Superman. Mm-hmm. And everything around that time. But, you know, I was liking Batman then, too.
Yeah.
And then, for some reason, like, I loved Justice League. Like, the team aspect of it. More so than like Avengers at that time. Mm-hmm. I maybe just because it felt like an all-star team. Mm-hmm. Instead of like a couple of superheroes put on a team. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but I'm still that way. I read everything now more so. I think I like search out different indie type stuff than normal, as Rob would probably say from my tweets.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Chris, I don't know where you first started jumping into like independent ones, but like when I started going to the comic book shop, then I would go and look at they had like just not walls but just like magazine racks. Mm-hmm. And or not really racks but like
like shelving.
Thank you, shelving. And so I'd go through and like see just random books, but it seemed like they were definitely subpar in terms of the art, but I would still buy, like, you know, in retrospect it was like maybe some Eclipse or First comics and stuff like that, but I could never really get in. I tried a lot of them, but I never could get into them. And I think that the first time I really got myself invested in a third comic book company more than just an issue here or issue there were probably when Valiant, and that, so that wasn't until, you know, the very early 90s when I was already like either just out of high school or mm-hmm. when did they start? 92? Or 90? I don't even know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that
early 90s at least.
Yeah. So I mean, I might have, if it was 92, I would have been turning 20. So, yeah, I mean, that was probably the first time I actually got invested in another comic book company rather than just buying an issue here or there of just random different companies just to try things out.
Yeah.
What about you, Chris?
Well, right before I stopped collecting comics as a kid was when all the artists that I liked at Marvel went over to Informed Image. Mm-hmm. So I briefly was all in on Image for a year or so, and then I quit comics altogether. But before that, though, I remember being aware of the fact that there were other comic books out there besides Marvel and DC. And I would end up with a few of them here and there randomly, but not, you know, because I sought them out or anything, just because I liked comics and somehow ended up with comics. But besides Image in those early days, then it wasn't really till I got back into comics in college around 2000 that I purposely was exploring everything that was available and checking out different stuff.
Forgot about Image. That would have been around the same time, and of course I was,
yeah,
you know, all in on trying all of those books, because it's like, you know, you have the biggest names in comics forming their own company, and you couldn't help but be interested to see what was going to happen.
Yeah, and that's totally what I was into at Marvel, were the artists.
Yeah.
And those particular ones. for better or worse.
But they did a good job of kind of reinventing themselves over the years, though, didn't they? Now, I don't mean the creators, but their company.
The company. Yeah, I mean, it's changed even from, even in the last couple of decades, even more so. But even coming back into comics at 2000 and discovering what Image was then compared to what Image was when they first started was really interesting as a returning fan.
Yeah, big time.
And just Vertigo and, you know, discovering, like, things like 100 Bullets and The Authority was big right then and in that universe and things like that that just was different than what was available when I was younger.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, cool. Oh my God. Allie is banging on the window screen from outside with her plastic shovel.
Nice. Yeah, she's probably good.
I don't know where Stacy is. Should be outside with these children. Well, I know she's outside, but I don't know where she is. She can't see them.
She's probably like stopping Zach from starting a fire or something.
No, because Zach's now doing the same thing.
Oh, okay. Maybe they hit her with the shovels before the...
Maybe, yeah, she's lying in the snow somewhere, bleeding. Oh, Lord.
They've been outside for 10 minutes, and they've gone Children of the Corn.
Exactly. Yeah, well, they, you know, they've got that twin connection. They don't have to talk.
Oh, yeah, twin. Like, I mean, that's one of the staples of horror movies.
Exactly.
Creepy twins.
Creepy twins.
And you're living with them.
I mean, they're not identical, so they lose some creepy points for not being identical, but still. I don't think I had anything else to ask Ronnie.
Yeah, I can't remember what questions Mike and I asked you.
He's
coming up with those.
Yeah, he does.
Well, I mean, we do venture outside of comic books on retro. I mean, our focus tends to be on comics, but we do venture outside of that a little bit. I mean, are there, so Ronnie, we know that you're definitely really big into comics and you're really big into Doctor Who. I mean, does that pretty much consume your time as far as hobbies and fandoms go, or is there anything that's really also big for you?
I mean, anything that's nerd culture, I'm pretty much into, so yeah.
You like wrestling, Ronnie.
Oh, I do like wrestling.
Right. You're a big wrestling fan. I always thought that your Twitter tag, that was just your birthday. That's how uninformed with wrestling I am.
Well,
he must have been born on March 16th.
No, actually the 16 just went on there because of wrestling, but I am the third. So it's the first three initials of my first name, first three of my last name, and then plus three. And then I just threw 16 on there because I am a wrestling fan, and it just flowed, I guess, at the time.
Nice.
But I work for a major university, and I do... I am a high school baseball coach as well.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's like I'm the jock nerd that nobody ever writes about.
Those things exist. I mean, I like baseball, but I'm kind of weird in that I didn't play growing up, and I only really became a baseball fan as an adult and got into the sport as an adult. Just, you know, watching Major League Baseball,
right?
But it's kind of cool because my dad and my grandfather are both into watching baseball also, so I kind of like being into it for that reason.
So yeah, between having four teenagers and comics and TV movie nerd stuff, and there's just not enough hours in the day.
Yeah, really? I can imagine, yeah. Four teenagers.
I don't know how you can possibly read any number of comic books Like, I think that, like, my time is limited with the 2 5-year-olds, but they go to bed and they don't, you know, they don't need a lot of. I don't. Where do you find any time to read at all?
Well, the teenagers are
let alone podcast as much as you do.
Yeah. Well, that's like me time, right?
Yeah.
Well, the teenagers are mine and hers. So, and they're older. Like, we have an 18, a 17, and 2 15s. Uh-huh. So, they're
self-sufficient.
Yeah. And then, usually late at night, like, I started switching from floppies to digital because I'd be laying in bed with the night lamp on, and Melissa's trying to sleep, and she's like, "Are you done yet?" And I wasn't done. So then... So then, like, I'd go from my tablet, and I'd be like, "Oh, well, it's the best of both worlds. I'm not done reading, and she can have the light out, and I can keep reading until I am tired." Because that's like my wind down time. No matter what time it is, I try to at least read 1 or 2 books a night just to slow everything down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine teenagers, they get to a certain age, they sort of want to do their own thing anyways. They don't really want to have to.
Yeah, and 2 can drive, and 2 has permits to drive, and the older 2 have jobs, so sometimes they're not even home during the week.
They're busy, yeah. Still, though, that's...
I guess that makes sense, but you still must have a very busy household.
Oh, yes. We don't eat on time. We eat in shifts. Because like now, I work 8 to 5, and that and my job's like 30-45 minutes away, and then from 6 to 8, then I have high school baseball practice, and then so then afterwards I'll pick up my daughter who's just getting out of soccer practice, or one of the boys, or from a church thing or something, and then we'll grab something to eat or leftovers, or the plates are still hot when we get here, so everybody else has already ate, so it's busy, that's for sure.
Yeah,
I'll bet.
Cool.
Oh, I am lucky enough that I can do some reading depending on the day at work, and
I could do that too. Yeah,
I'll take a lunch break too, and I'll because I sometimes I can eat at my desk, so when I actually take my lunch break away from my desk, I'll just bring comics and read.
Yeah. That's the good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, do you want to start with, do you got a book that you want to cover, Ronnie? Would you like to start? You're our guest, after all.
Sure. I picked 2 books, actually. One, because I went down a deep rabbit hole. I picked Quasar 17, which is...
I saw that you tweeted that you read that. So.
Yeah. Okay, so the rabbit hole I went down real fast was at our local big con 2 weekends ago. Scott Snyder and Craig Capullo and Tom King and Clay Mann were there.
Yeah, by the way, I'm super jealous.
So we got press passes for it, and nice. Capullo did the art on our press pass. So I was like, well, they were having a big Gotham or DC Metal panel and everything. So I tried to pick something for Capullo to sign that wasn't metal. And so I started going through my long boxes, and he started with issue 18, actually, of Quasar. And so,
right, yeah.
But I saw the cover for 17, and I was like, oh, I need to go back to that, which is Who Will Be the Fastest One Alive. So it's basically like a cosmic race, and it has Captain Marvel, Photon Captain Marvel, actually, and then Speed Demon and Super Saber and Black Racer and Quicksilver and the Wizard and Macacary. I don't know how you say his name, really.
Yeah, what is he? Is he one of the Eternals or something?
Yeah, he is. And then Quasar, obviously. And so I was like, when I was looking for 18, I was like, oh, I'm going to go back to and read that because I really thought the cover was cool. Well, then you speed up to like last week, and in the current Deathstroke, there's a panel, and the guy looks exactly like Punisher. Like, he has a skull on his shirt and everything. So I thought that was kind of weird that it was just like the artist playing jokes, like, you know, they're working for DC, but they throw a Marvel character in there, blah, blah, blah. So I went down the rabbit hole to how many times has this happened? Because obviously, you know, we're in 2018. That's not the first time that somebody's done that. So apparently this is the first well-known one, as to where, like I said, in the book they have the great cosmic race, because the runner, which is a god, I guess, speeds past the ship, and he's collecting, or he's asking everybody, all the speedsters of Earth, to run from Earth to the moon, and who will be titled the fastest man alive. And so they all start running, and Mac, which is, I don't know how to say his name actually, but Quasar calls him Mac. So
Makari, I think.
Makari, yeah. And so he really wants to, he's like the arrogant Johnny Storm attitude-ish guy. So he wants to outrace everybody. And so they're doing the race, and you can see like from 5,000 kilometers to 10,000 kilometers, and the signs from Earth to the moon, and everybody's like, Quicksilver said that he was raised on the moon or did stuff in the moon, so his stamina is not as good as everybody else's, and Max pushing himself and pushing himself, and then in the last like quarter mile to the finish line, Speed Force happens, and another runner comes in, and he doesn't know who he is or where he's from, or all he knows is that he wants to go home and that he needs to run. So he takes off running, and he enters himself into the race, and he wins. And so the runner, which is he's all decked out in gold, asks him what his name is, and he says that he can't remember, but he thinks it's something that sounds like Buried Alien, which for all fans would know that it's like Barry Allen. And his costume is just like yellow boots and tattered red shorts, and he has long hair and a scruffy type beard at this point. And so, I mean, it's basically just a, like a one-off story. Like, Mac is really disappointed that he didn't win the race, and him and Quasar comforts him, and then they go off and do their thing. And the runner takes Buried Alien, quote-unquote, home. So, what I thought, and that was a cool story that they alluded to Barry Allen. I mean, it was pretty obvious, and I did some research on it. And this was like 6 months after the Cosmic Treadmill story for DC.
Oh, really? That?
Okay. Yeah. So they hadn't even used Barry Allen for a while. And so I'm assuming the artist was like, hey, they're not using him, so maybe we'll just have him show up here or there. So, and I picked that book also because I just finished at the con. I picked up the last two issues of Quasar that I needed to complete the run too.
Well, that's so cool.
Nice.
You know, I wanted to ask you, have you read the majority of that series? I was going to ask. I haven't read any of it, so I was just wondering if it's how much you enjoy it.
I read it a lot, or I read it as it was coming out back then. That was like one of the crazy ones that I was picking up off the rack.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I really enjoyed it. And then when Annihilation happened for Marvel, they have Annihilation Quasar 2, And so it brought it back, brought that love of the book back.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Now, it's not really one of those that stand out or stand up to the test of time, because there's some pretty cheesy, hokey stuff in a couple of issues, but for the most part, it's kind of cool, cosmic, sci-fi type fun.
I mean, I ask because Mark Grunwald wrote, but look, I'm looking, and it looks like he wrote like the entire series with,
yeah,
actually, yeah, maybe like what looks like one issue was a fill-in. But I mean, here, so we read the whole thing, and I loved his Captain America run, back in the, I guess it would have been the 80s and maybe even into the 90s. So yeah, I mean, this actually intrigues me in terms of, well, maybe, I mean, I love him as a writer. So, and it's something that I've never dipped my toe in. I literally, I mean, I do not own one issue of this entire series. So something that just might be a whole brand new thing that I could read, you know?
Yeah. And it's on Marvel Unlimited as well. So
no, Ronnie, I don't know if you knew this, but I just recently got Marvel Unlimited.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris and Mike made me.
Well, you tweeted out suggestions, and I gave you some suggestions.
Yes, you did. Yep.
So,
but yeah, I don't know if you, our last time that we got together to podcast, Chris was telling me how there was that Black Panther promo sale.
Yeah.
And it was like $5 a month. It's like, my God, even though I'm buying on DCBS, that's still like 3 comic books.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, and so I'm like, how can I not? And plus, honestly, you know, I hate to say it, but fresh new start, although there are books that I'll probably pick up that I wasn't getting before, there's also going to be books that I'm just going to stop buying. Like, it's a perfect jumping off point.
Right.
Basically. Yeah. So, so if I can, you know, if I reduce myself by at least 3 books, then I'm actually saving money by, I can read it through this instead, you know, 6 months down the line.
Yep. So, plus there's older stuff that you don't have to go buried.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, now I'm, well, and that's the good thing too. Cause a while back I tweeted Nick to give me a heads up if he ever sees the Masterworks for Fantastic Four on those deep sales that me and him have gotten all the old Spider-Mans on.
Right.
But now, I mean, that first whole 102 issues with Kirby and Lee for Fantastic Four are all on Marvel Unlimited, so now I can read them.
Yep.
And as well as Chris and Mike usually will do a shared book, like somebody will pick one book that we'll all read so we can discuss. And especially, I think Mike, even more so than you, Chris, lately, because he is Marvel Unlimited, he'll read stuff at night, and so he'll often pick a book that he read on Marvel Unlimited. And up to this point, I just went on, and I have to, you know, it's not a lot of money, it's $1.99, but you know, I just would pay $1.99 if I didn't already own it to read it. So now I don't have to worry.
Yeah, it works out for everybody.
It does.
Yep.
You're a good salesman, Chris.
Well, we were just concerned that you didn't have enough comics to read already, you know?
Yeah. My God. Yeah, now I'm sticking, you know, the Fantastic Four a couple, 2 or 3 issues, trying to get, you know, 2 or 3 issues in every week or so, in addition to all my current comics and the old ones that I'll, like, you know, the trades that I'll pick up and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's okay. I mean, my wife didn't want to spend any time with, my wife and kids don't want to spend any time with me anyhow, so I can just sit here and just read comic books all day, I guess.
I mean, they're busy bashing the house with their snow shovels anyways.
So. It's funny that you said that. Zach just walked up and threw a snowball at the house.
Nice.
The rebellion already starts.
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I hadn't kept up for a while on what was... there's been times where I've kept an eye on what was being added to Marvel Unlimited. Mostly keep my eye on the older stuff, the back catalog that was being added, because I know that the new stuff is going to be consistently coming in. And I was interested to see your tweet, Ronnie, because I didn't realize that they had added more Kazar. I think when the last time I had checked it, just issue one was on there or something. And I didn't read a lot of Kazar, but I came across a few issues of it when I was younger. And it was always intriguing to me in the same way that when I was reading... I read Silver Surfer for a while when Ron Lim was the penciler.
Artist.
And, I think Jim Starlin was writing it, but that the Marvel Cosmic was appealing to me just because of the strange characters, and that Kazar 17 cover is definitely epitomizes that with the characters that are arrayed there. A lot of them aren't your commonly seen characters, and that goes for a lot of Marvel Cosmic. There's some pretty strange characters.
Yep.
So that's cool to see they added that stuff. Or some more of it, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great service, and we talked about it last time, Chris. And I mean, I would go nuts if they had a DC Unlimited. But as I was browsing through past couple days, it's cool to see that they do have a handful of like 1940s comics too, like All Winners and stuff like that. So those are ones that I want to kind of dip my toe into too, just to read some really old ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they don't have, like, a lot of their old ones are typically sci-fi type based monster books and stuff like that, because that's what pretty much Timely was doing at the time. But it's still, you know, interesting. I like reading, when I'm in the mood, some of those real old comics too. Mm-hmm. But if DC ever did it, oh my God, I don't know what I would do, because I don't have any more time to read more comics, but I would absolutely love it.
Yeah, if they had a similar service, I think that would just be my main source of comic book reading. And I probably wouldn't really need a lot of the back issues. A lot of the reason I have a lot of the back issues I have is because DC doesn't have a service like that.
Right.
But people have been talking about DC having a similar service for almost as long as Marvel Unlimited has been around, you know, and seem to have a different strategy, but you never know, maybe someday.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, a lot of the like Tales of Suspense, Tales to Astonish, a lot of those books that became superhero books in the 60s, a lot of those go back earlier, like you said, prior to the superheroes, and start earlier than that, so you got some of the monster stuff and whatnot. Even some of the older romance comics and stuff are on there.
Yeah, it's cool. It's not just a lot,
but yeah,
every once in a while I'm just in the mood for something. Yeah, I want to actually experience something that was really in the early age of comics.
Some golden age stuff.
Yeah.
Well, what did you
I like reading like the actual if I can get my hands on them, the physical copies, because I would say just as much as I enjoy reading the story, I like looking at all the old ads too.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to get that through this experience.
Yeah, I do like the way that can contextualize it. Comics of any era that when they still had ads.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe up through like the 90s is where it's still kind of interesting to me to see the ads.
Yeah. After that, it just really became almost just ads for their other comics.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Ads for Sea Monkeys and X-Ray Glasses.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I remember reading an old X-Men. Might have been even number one, and I'm going through and reading it, and there's one of those where there's, you know, lots of different ads all on one page, but one was probably about a third or fourth of the whole page. Selling live squirrel monkeys, just live monkeys through the mail. Not squirrel monkeys. Sorry, the capuchin monkeys, those little ones.
Oh, okay. No,
I'm like, seriously? They're selling monkey, like actual monkeys, through the mail. And it says, you know, feed them this, that, or even candy bars. They'll eat anything you eat. I'm like, oh my God. That could not have turned out good for anyone involved, monkey or the people.
No. Yeah, That sounds bad. And yes, and sea monkeys aren't... they aren't monkeys. Or... I forget what they are. They're some kind of weird...
They're type of a shrimp, I think.
Shrimp, yeah, or something like that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Really strange.
Yeah. And they don't look anything like those cartoons, Ronnie.
I know. I'm disappointed.
Yeah. Did you get sea monkeys when you were a kid?
I'm sure I had. And I'm sure I had a pet rock, too.
You can... I think you can still buy those.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm sure you can.
Yeah.
They make the little cartoon sea monkeys look cool. And you're like,
yes,
oh,
they do.
I can grow a whole farm of them.
Oh, my God, that one wears a crown.
Yeah.
He's the king.
He's the king of the sea monkeys.
I think I might have briefly had sea monkeys, and the key word there being briefly. It's hard, and I think that's why it's hard to remember, because I think they died almost instantly.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I just brought up Wikipedia. It says many purchasers were disappointed by the dissimilarity and by the short lifespan of the animals. Because it says these showed humanoid animals that bear no resemblance to the crustaceans. That was a great marketing campaign.
Yeah, because I think he made like millions or at that time.
I'm sure he did.
I think I'm going to say like last week or the week before, I listened to a podcast about it, actually.
Really?
Yeah. It was like Stuff You Should Know, I think, was the podcast. And they were talking about the craze of the sea monkeys and the x-ray glasses and whatnot.
That's awesome. I always wanted x-ray glasses.
Yeah.
I did too, especially after hitting puberty.
Right. But there was always a part of me that knew that those can't possibly work, that I could actually see through somebody's clothes.
No.
Because I would hear more about them.
Right. Everybody would have them at that point.
Right. They wouldn't just be in a corner of a comic book. Yeah, like, these would be things that everyone would be wearing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like my dad would have one.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. See? I'm proud to say I was smart enough to work that out as well.
Yeah. Like, there has to be something about these. But you're not really going to get the experience that you're hoping for.
Just like you're probably not going to look like Charles Atlas if you like sign for his exercise program. People are going to still kick sand in your eye.
No right. Funny.
Oh, Rob, did you have something you wanted to cover?
You know, it's funny. I knew that we were going to do a podcast, and I actually did prepare material.
That's so strange.
I know. Isn't that awesome?
It's weird how that happens, even with snow being thrown at you and the house being beat on. You managed to...
Yeah, well, I took care of this earlier. But, as I told you guys, I'm trying to start reading some old Fantastic Four because... In all those early issues, I think I've only read the Galactus issue and the two Black Panther issues, and that's probably it. Or I think I actually own one or two that are in the like 80s, whatever, like in the 80s, not 1980s, but the numbering.
Right.
So that's probably it, about it. But anyhow, I'm going to cover Fantastic Four number 2, and I'll just briefly go through the beats with this one, but it's the first appearance of the Skrulls. And I had no idea that the Skrulls made such early appearance. Mm. And, at the time, being that this was only the second issue, I mean, you could tell... I think this is really interesting. The early issues of the Fantastic Four, especially issue 1, 2, and 3, and I've read issue 4 as well, but 1, 2, and 3, like, you could tell, you could see... the transformation of Marvel from being like a sci-fi and monster company to going towards superheroes, because these first two or three issues are really just, I mean, they don't really have costumes. They're four individuals that obviously got powers, from the cosmic radiation, but it was just really, really well done. And you can see that the theme is kind of like they're encountering different kind of like science fiction experiences, and it's not like the typical, okay, they're up against a supervillain. Yes, there was the Mole Man in the first one, but you know, he had all those monsters and stuff like that, so that was, you know, direct theme with those giant monsters that Marvel always had, and here,
yeah,
they
encounter. Like, not to interrupt you, but the Mole Man, the Mole Man himself's not that much of a stretch, really. I mean, he's just like, right. He's a creepy dude that lives underground. Like, he's not it's not a huge jump from scary monsters and stuff. Yeah,
yeah, not at all. And in issue two is the first appearance of the Skrulls, and again, it's just they're like weird looking aliens. And I mean, you could tell just by reading this, just this one issue, and if you had gone no further, they very well could have been just a, you know, one and done appearance. Mm-hmm. Just a weird alien that they're aliens that they were encountering, and then they took, you know, took care of them, and that's the end. And then the next issue they go to something else. But how this one starts is it shows each one of the Fantastic Four in turn, starting with the Thing and moving on to the others, either stealing stuff or destroying things. So the Thing, for some reason, swims to a offshore drilling center, oil rig, and he destroys that. And then it cuts to Sue Storm at this expensive jewelry store, and she's taking a look at a $10 million diamond, and then suddenly she and the diamond disappear, and the torch goes to this unveiling of a new monument in the area, and he flies through it and totally melts it down, and Reed Richards, or Mr. Fantastic, turns off the power in the whole city. And so what you find out is it's not the Fantastic Four at all. Rather, it's these four aliens that have used technology to simulate the Fantastic Four's powers. So it's these Skrulls that are impersonating the Fantastic Four. And what their plan is they want humanity to turn on the Fantastic Four. And once that happens, the Fantastic Four will either be imprisoned or destroyed by the world's population, and there'll be no one left to stop the Skrulls from invading the planet. So they so that's their plan, and then it cuts to the actual Fantastic Four, and they're actually in at a hunting lodge. They're doing a little vacationing, and they're just talking, and you see a little bit of the interaction between the Thing and Human Torch already, kind of getting on each other's nerves, which is interesting that it's really already starting, and you know, very early on, that kind of dynamic, which is another reason why I'm enjoying Fantastic Four, is that family dynamic. It's a lot, it's not the same thing, but it's the same reason why I enjoy the Spider-Man comics from the very, very beginning, is that whole personal part of Peter Parker's story intermingled with his heroic identity. I thought that they, in both cases, they do a good job making these actual people that you care about, not just, you know, generic superheroes. But anyhow, so while they're at this hunting lodge, they have no idea that these Skrulls were impersonating them and doing all these crazy things. So the army actually find out where the Fantastic Four are and surround them and force them to come out. And the you know, Reed says, you know, we're not gonna fight the army. So they take them to a federal prison designed to hold each one of them, but they're each able to actually, through their powers, they're actually able to escape and get away. So they eventually find out what's going on with them being impersonated, and they end up tracking down the Skrulls. And actually, Johnny Storm is able to pretend that he's the Skrull rather than himself, and he And he joins the other three. And when he does that, it's the first appearance of that the Fantastic Four flare gun that shoots the four up into the air. So he does that and calls the rest of them, and they end up capturing the Skrulls. And here they have these aliens, and they're not quite sure what to do with them. But they decide that rather than destroying them, they would hypnotize them and make them forget what they were doing. And so the end of the story is they end up hypnotizing them so they forget their previous identities, and they shapeshift into cows.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing that you see. It's four cows just going moo, and the Fantastic Four walking away. You know, it's like the countryside, and you know, Reed says, "So ends the menace of the Skrulls." So it's really cool that that's how. And like, I knew about that ending, but I had never read the story before, so it was really fun. And I want to say, I don't know if either one of you remember, but I want to say that that's been addressed recently in the past, I mean, not real recent, but in the past 10 or so years.
Yeah.
Something about them, but I don't remember what that was.
Yeah, Bendis brought it back, I think maybe around Secret Wars time or something like that, or...
Oh, okay,
One of the... Or was it Secret Invasion, maybe, like, what the...
I think it was...
That was with the Skrulls.
Yeah, I think it was Secret Invasion. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, he brought back the fact that there are these Skrulls that were stuck as cows. Yeah.
It was... I mean, it was funny that I knew that as, like, part of Marvel/Fantastic Four history, but I had never read the story, and it was just fun to actually read it and see them all as cows at the very end. And you know, I forgot to mention, but also the Fantastic Four shot up a rocket and kind of scared that mothership away, and the Skrull said, you know, the Fantastic Four cannot be defeated, and then they left Earth. The ship left Earth, so they wouldn't invade. But yeah, those four Skrulls turning into cows, that was the best. And Ronnie, you don't read Harley Quinn, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay, there was a issue, a rebirth issue, that was very similar, and that I don't remember the entire story, but some sort of aliens were turned into some animals, whether it was cows or pigs, I don't remember which, and they had been that way, just like in this story. But then they were sent to slaughter, and they were made into hot dogs. And anyone eating those hot dogs were, like, turning into zombies because it had alien DNA in it.
I think I remember Mike or you talking about that one.
It was probably Mike then, because I don't think I covered it. But, but yeah, so that was very amusing because I'm like, I knew enough that it was the take on the Fantastic Four Skrull story. But it was funny because, you know, of course, being Harley Quinn, they had to take it all the way to another level.
Right.
Actually killing them in a slaughterhouse and poisoning people to turn into zombies by eating the hot dogs they were made from. So that was pretty humorous. But yeah, this was a good story. I'm definitely enjoying. I've read the first four issues so far. So Dr. Doom is next. It's very interesting. It's fun to read these old stories.
Yeah. You mentioned the one aspect as far as the connections to Marvel's past, and I think one of the other things that I found interesting about reading early Fantastic Four was just how Stan and Jack were really, you know, really firing on all cylinders as far as issue by issue, just coming up with these concepts that would, you know, that are still in use today. You know,
it's really crazy. That, and I know that, you know, Stan Lee can get a bad rap sometimes because he in the past had liked to take credit for doing everything, where obviously he had co-creators, but he still did have his hand in all of these heroes, him, Kirby, Ditko. It's incredible that just those few people basically formed the Marvel Universe that everyone knows today.
Yeah.
And that it's still popular. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, even if he didn't do everything, which he clearly didn't, that doesn't mean he didn't do anything, you know?
Exactly. So. And you can tell that by reading, like, you can read a Fantastic Four, and you can read a Spider-Man, and then you can read a Spider-Man after Ditko, and they all sound similar. So Stan Lee definitely had his hand in that. Mm-hmm. You know, because those are three different artists that he worked with, whether it was Romita or Ditko or Kirby. So he you know, he definitely had a big part in, well, I mean, obviously so, but, you know, I think a lot of times because he was so enthusiastic to take full credit of this, you know, he gets that kind of, you know, a bad rap sometimes. Mm-hmm. But he definitely had a lot to do with it, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
Cool. Chris, what do you have for us?
All right, well, I'll keep us considering that we're talking about Marvel of that era. I'll keep us in that same era with Tales of Suspense issue 65. Mm. I think this is actually, we covered an issue of Tales of Suspense, all three of us, a few episodes ago that I picked because I had a physical copy of it, but it was kind of jumping forward for me in terms of where I was at in reading my periodic old Marvel in order that I've been doing for years and have made very slow progress with. But this is a split Iron Man and Captain America issue. So it starts with the Iron Man story, which is Stan Lee and Don Heck. It's called When Titans Clash, and the sort of the grabber, I don't know what the right word is, but the thing to pull you in is on this story is that it's Iron Man versus Iron Man. I would think probably for the first time you have something that's definitely happened again in the future or beyond this. You have Iron Man, you have Tony Stark having to go back and use an older version of his armor to battle someone who's gotten control of his current suit. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it opens up with a lot of Marvel at this time had some heavy romance stuff. And I'm finding that I've found that Iron Man is particularly heavy on that with the love triangle with Tony and Pepper and Happy Hogan. And that's kind of where this issue opens. It was some pretty heavy stuff of that, where Tony's planning to leave his business, not leave the business itself, but to be around Pepper less because he doesn't want to get into a relationship with her because of his heart condition, and he wants her to. He knows Happy has a thing for her, and he wants Happy to, her and Happy to be together, even though it's killing him and torturing him inside. It's very, very emo.
What a guy.
Yeah. So he goes to one of his arms factories to observe this weapon that they've got that you fire. It's like a little mini missile that you fire at a larger missile, and it attaches itself, and then you can control the larger missile and either, you know, bring it down safely or destroy it or whatever. But while he's doing that, it turns out he was so out of sorts and distracted by the whole ordeal with Pepper and whatnot that he forgot to take his Iron Man armor in its little suitcase with him, and left it behind at his main factory. And this criminal sneaks in by hitching a ride on a delivery truck, and he's in there just to try to make some cash off of stealing some plans and that kind of thing. And when he comes across the case, and it's got AS, the initials for Anthony Stark on there, so he's like, oh, this must be important, basically. And not only was Tony upset enough to leave it behind, he even let the he even left the protective device on it unset, which would normally make it explode if somebody other than him touched it. But he even let that, he was even out of sorts enough to let that not be engaged. So this guy, I think his name is Weasel, he opens it up and ends up, over time, figuring out how to put the Iron Man armor on and how to use it. And he doesn't have any trouble escaping because he puts the helmet on. People don't know who Iron Man is other than the fact that he's Tony's bodyguard. And so when he walks out in the full armor, the guard's just kind of puzzled at the fact that he's around at that hour, but otherwise he can take off, which is probably the most plausible part of this. So it kind of jumps forward in time. Weasel Wills is his full name. It jumps forward in time to sort of give him the opportunity to practice the armor and get used to it. And then he starts, of course, going on a crime spree. And you know, the papers pick up on it, start covering the fact that Iron Man is on this crime spree. And so Tony finally finds out through the paper and realizes he's got to head back and do something about it. So yeah, that's where he digs out his old armor, the full yellow, larger original armor, and puts that on. From there, it's basically just a battle between the two, where Tony has to overcome the disadvantage of the less powerful armor, and also the fact that even more so the fact that that armor, one of the reasons that he discarded it and built the new armor was that it was too much of a strain on his heart and didn't support his heart in the way that the new armor does. So the way he overcomes that is kind of through superior knowledge of the armor, even though the Weasel, he's gotten pretty used to using it and stuff. Tony makes a point not to drain all the energy, use up all the energy of his suit, and he kind of goads and tricks Weasel into using up the transistor power on his Iron Man suit, and Tony had earlier disabled the power to the place so that he wasn't able to recharge and stuff. And so the whole thing, I actually expected Weasel to die, because Weasel, obviously at this point, I mean, he knows Tony Stark is Iron Man, and he's the only one that knows the secret at this point. And usually when that happens, obviously Iron Man's not going to kill him, but he's probably going to die inadvertently somehow. So that's what I was expecting to happen, but instead they went the route that he goes crazy.
Oh, yeah, so that's the other one. Yeah. Crazy / amnesia.
Yeah, he goes crazy, and he's at that point, when they take him away at the end of the story, he's convinced that he's Iron Man for real. and so so Tony's secret is safe. But it ends again with super emo Tony. Pepper and Happy are talking about the fact that Happy says something along the lines of, whoever Iron Man is, he's the luckiest guy in the world, he's got everything. And Tony says, perhaps, but sometimes a person can seem to possess all that anyone could ever want and still have nothing. And Happy and Pepper are just kind of left to ponder what the heck he's talking about. But
Poor guy,
he goes off into his never-ending sorrow. And the second story is about Stan and Jack. Of course, it's a Captain America story, and it actually takes place in the 1940s. There's a caption on the first page that says that because it takes place in the 1940s, they decided to do it in the style of the 1940s. And I mean, I haven't read a ton of Golden Age comic books, but it doesn't. The only thing that really kind of strikes me as being that way is that Jack kind of sticks pretty much to a 6-panel grid with an occasional panel that stretches across.
I gave Mommy my guitar.
That was just Zach. He's telling me something.
Yeah, I was just listening.
Oh, very nice. I got a sticker of Optimus Prime just now.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I heard him say, I gave Mommy something. I thought maybe it was
Megatron.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Mom.
Your shovel's coming next, Daddy.
Sorry to interrupt.
No problem. So, yeah, this is a 1940s story about the Red Skull showing Steve and Bucky are in their soldier identity and stuff, and they're dropping off Major Cody at his place, and that evening it's kind of amusing. The Red Skull just climbs in through the window behind Major Cody when he's sitting, like, smoking a pipe and reading a book. And, you know, the Red Skull, it just climbs in through the window in what kind of looks like Nazi pajamas, basically. He's just got this green jumper on with a big swastika on the.
It's on the cover, too. I see that.
I think so, yeah. It's kind of funny. But so anyway, he kills him, what it comes down to, basically, the story is the Red Skull is taking out a few different people in the army to get his hands on a particular experiment. Bucky and Steve are, you know, switch back and forth between their soldier identity and their superhero identity, track down the Red Skull through the fact that he also has men out robbing a bank to gather funds for the Third Reich, and Bucky follows them, not knowing that they're connected, and then finds out that the Red Skull is there too, and gets in a little bit of hot water until Cap shows up as well to help out, but the Red Skull escapes, and they have to just leave him be for now, and catch up with him later. So the second sort of scene takes place on an army base where they have a Mr. Maxon of a Maxon Aircraft Corporation that is shown up to supervise the testing of his bomber, and there ends up being a problem with it, and it crashes, and there's sort of a funny moment where Steve gets in trouble because he's offended that Maxon is more concerned with the fact that the aircraft failure than the lives of the soldiers that were flying and stuff, and so he snaps at him and gets in trouble for being out of order. But it turns out that when the Red Skull was behind the sabotage as well, and they fight Red Skull again, and in this case the Red Skull's just a mask, and they pull it off, and it's Maxon, not the real John Maxon, he says. So there's some kind of, they don't really go into detail, but there's some kind of implication that you know, he took his form, or it's an additional disguise beneath the Red Skull mask. I'm not really sure what the specifics of that are, but it does end on a cliffhanger with the Red Skull escaping again, under cover of machine gun fire. It ends with Captain America finding a notepad. It's got Major Croy and General Curtis, the two victims in the story, and their names crossed out, and Captain America and Bucky, their names are on there, but not crossed out yet. so they find his kill list, basically. So it teases that the next issue is going to have more, that you're going to learn the truth about the Red Skull, and it's going to be the start of one of the greatest Captain America wartime epics ever presented. So
very nice.
Yeah.
So that's
are those on Unlimited too?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh good, because I'm trying to finish off my Captain America collection, but I have almost no Tales of Suspense. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to read those.
Yeah, all those Tales of Suspense, and then going into the solo series, are all in there. Same with Iron Man.
Nice.
And that's the first Silver Age appearance of the Red Skull. Right.
Is it okay? I kind of had that feeling, but I didn't confirm it.
As George John Maxson.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's all I know, but...
Yeah. No, cool. I'm kind of curious as to how they'll kind of write out his origin and... or whatever the details that they'll go into in the next issue to kind of flesh that out, so to speak. So, Ronnie, you said you had another book that you read?
I did. This one, it's not as old as like the ones that we have, but it still meets our criteria.
Oh, yeah, it's fine.
It's The Lone Ranger number 1 from 2006.
Mm.
That's cool.
And that was like when Dynamite started. It was, I would say, 6 months to a year is when Dynamite first started up around that time. So they didn't really have that many books coming out. Mm. And it is by Brett Matthews and Sergio Cariello as the artist, and John Cassidy doing the cover art and the art layouts, basically. But at that time, that was like when I was going Kitty bar the door of everything comic wise, but I was kind of burnt out on the Capes and Cowls. Mm-hmm. So it really stuck out to me. And of course, like my grandpa and my dad always watched Lone Ranger, so I wanted to check it out, and it was more like the number one is obviously the origin, where you have John and his dad, and it's kind of funny because now looking back on it, John's dad, which is the Lone Ranger, or who becomes the Lone Ranger, his dad is drawn like Sam Elliott. only with blonde hair. And there's a couple of panels where his dad's already a Lone Ranger, or a Texas Ranger. Mm-hmm. and John's very small, and he's happy to see his dad come home, but his dad's like in a somber mood, and come to find out he had to kill a guy, or the bad guy, and then he tells John that it's not bad, or it's not always good to kill the bad guy, and he can't come into the house until he figures out the reason why, which I thought was kind of harsh, but, you know, because at this point it looks like John's only 8 to 10, I would say.
Yeah.
And you can't come. You can't leave this tree stump until you figure out why I said that. But so you see his dad laying in bed, and he busts through the door and tells him that sometimes you have to kill the cow to make bacon, which is another like. But But then it fast forwards to where John graduates college, and his dad and his brother are there, and they're both Texas Rangers, and they want John to have a different life, but he wants to be a Texas Ranger no matter what. So one night at supper, they hand him his badge, and then you fast forward to where the comic's taking place now, and it's the whole, all the Texas Rangers going after a bandit in a canyon ravine, and they get ambushed by bandits, and John is the only one left alive, and one of the bandits goes back to make sure that they're all dead, and he's getting ready to shoot John because John is the only one that's conscious and moving, and an arrow goes right through his heart, which would be Tonto. And like this whole thing, like it ends with Tonto next to the campfire, and he's talking to John about I'm sorry that you're the only one left alive, so you're the Lone Ranger. And but it also there's only like two or three panels of the bad guy that put the hit on the Texas Rangers, basically. And so I thought that was kind of weird that it was all origin of the Lone Ranger, but only like two or three panels of the main bad guy, which is Black Bart. But like I said, I picked that one because I've always loved that series, and back then it was like fresh and new, and kind of a modernized take on the Lone Ranger, even though it still was set back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. But it was more of a mature edge to it than like what we saw on TV.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, I remember when this series was coming out, and by the time I kind of considered maybe picking it up, it was already quite a way into the run, so I never did, but I remember I had heard a lot of good things about it when it was coming out.
Yeah, it's definitely, it was like one of my weaknesses for a while, because it was like one of those books that no matter if it came out or not, then like I saw it, and it was like the time of variant covers, so mm-hmm. I got deep into that rabbit hole too.
Yeah, number one has quite a few variant covers.
Yeah, and then I think there was like Collector's Corner, I think, was the old computer database back then. I want to say it's Collector something. Okay. I didn't look, but they were doing a exclusive cover for it that was 1 in 200.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah, for like $25 or something back then, which was a lot back then for a brand new book. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, I say back then, but it was, what, 12 years ago? So I anteed up that and actually got that black and white cover. But now it's going to bother me because it's like Collector something, but I don't remember what it was. But it was an app, or well, not an app because you didn't have apps, but it was like a computer database, and it had all of the current covers, and you can mark what you had, what you didn't. It was like one of the first.
I remember that, yeah.
It was like one of the first ones because it started off being free for like the first 6 months, and then they changed it, and then you started had to pay for it.
Hmm. I'm trying to. I can't think of what that was called either.
Yeah,
was it? It might have been Collector's Corner. I don't know.
Yeah, it might have been. I was thinking.
Yeah, I've read some Dynamite Lone Ranger, but I think it must have been after they rebooted it or started another version of it or something like that. I think.
Yeah, they were bad about that.
Yeah, Dynamite, yeah, in general. I think Phil Hester was involved in the volume that I read a little bit of. But Yeah, I don't really have like much of a history with that property.
Me neither. But it's been interesting to me.
Yeah, but I think it was the stuff I did check out. I think was just because I liked the idea of a Western comic.
Yeah,
kind
right.
of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's cool to hear about that.
Mm-hmm. All right. I guess should I cover another one here?
Sure.
All right. So, this morning I grabbed some of the. I got a big stack of comic books that I have gotten. Chris probably at some of the conventions we've gone to and stuff that I still haven't read. So I read ROM number 17 today.
Okay.
And on the cover, it shows ROM holding a young boy by the throat and Wolverine on his other arm trying to slash him, and Storm and Nightcrawler and Colossus running into the room, guest starring the Uncanny X-Men. So I said, how can you beat this? It starts out with the X-Men, and they're being called by Professor X. Oh, I should say that Bill Mantlo is the writer and Sal Buscema is the artist. And Chris Claremont is the consultant. So this is came out in 1981, and Kitty Pryde is very new, so new that Professor X calls the team in because Cerebro has discovered something, and she doesn't know what a Cerebro is. So they explain what that is to her, and Professor X says that it's a very strange reading that it's getting, that it's supposed to detect mutants, but it's kind of a off reading, as if the mutant might actually not even be a human being. So that's just the first two pages. So he dismisses his X-Men to go to this location to figure out what's going on. From that point on, the story is focused on this family of husband, wife, and their 15-year-old son. Basically, what it's turned out is that the man, he actually is a dire wraith, but he had crash landed about 5 years before the wraiths in general came to Earth to kind of infiltrate humanity. Now, if you're not familiar with ROM or with dire wraiths, ROM is a space knight whose mission is to ferret out and destroy this alien race called Dire Wraiths. And Dire Wraiths can basically shapeshift. They have a variety of powers, but they can shapeshift to appear as regular people. And their mission was basically to, you know, kind of infiltrate humanity and then take over the world. But anyhow, and that happened in 1945 in the confusion after the end of World War II. This particular Dire Wraith had crash landed on the planet independently 5 years before that. And he actually legitimately started, he turned himself to look human. And he legitimately actually came to appreciate humanity, and then years later actually fell in love with this woman and married her. And they now have a 15-year-old son. So this 15-year-old is half human and half Dire Wraith. As we get into this issue, what we learn is that the wife, the human wife, has been basically drained of almost all of her energy, where now she appears that even though she's in her 30s, she appears to be like a hundred-year-old woman. And Ram arrives and tries to get this woman help. He sends her away. He starts talking to the husband, who, as I said, is a dire wraith, but he quickly learns that his history, and that he actually doesn't pose any particular trouble or any danger. What ends up being the case is that the dire wraiths in general have discovered this man and discovered that he has a hybrid son. And they came just recently and initiated his son in the ways of the Wraiths. So his son now is abnormally powerful than any other Wraith, due to being, I'm assuming, although it's not stated yet in this issue, that that combination of genes has resulted in him being an alien mutant. So he's drained, they live on a farm, and he's drained all of the livestock of all of their life force. There's just dead animals all over the place. He's obviously drained his mother down to that she's barely still living. And so Ram ends up going in to confront the boy, and so he turns from his human shape to this creepy, like, alien. I mean, he doesn't look like a regular dire wraith. He almost looks like almost insectoid, but he's really creepy looking. He's got like a big head with big eyes and really weird, like, melty skin.
Does he have a snow shovel?
He does not have a snow shovel. But so they start fighting, and you know, Ram's really struggling against this particular this hybrid. In the fight, the father comes in to try to get his son to stop, and with using his mutant abilities, he lifts up a pitchfork and impales his own father against the wall, and his father, as all dire wraiths do, dissolves into dust on the floor. They continue to battle, and then in the very it turns out that he can't banish this hybrid for whatever reason using his energy gun. So he's about to set it to actually kill him when the boy hears a commotion, transforms himself to look like a 15-year-old boy again, just as the X-Men, Nightcrawler, Storm, Colossus, Wolverine, and Kitty Pryde arrive. And so it appears that Ram is beating up, has destroyed, well, the house is totally destroyed. There's almost nothing left of the house. Looks like Ram has destroyed the house and is about to assassinate a 15-year-old boy. This is the X-Men's first encounter with Ram. Again, it's only issue 17, so he hasn't been encountering very many superheroes. And so this sets up the next issue where there's going to be a huge fight between Ram and the X-Men. So although the cover said that they were guest starring, they really only appeared on three pages in the whole comic, and really didn't, was just introduced them and then set it up for next issue as the big battle. I think I had read issue 18 years and years and years ago. So when I saw this one that had them on the cover, I'm like, oh, I don't have this, and I picked it up. It was enjoyable for what it was, but there was a lot of exposition with the whole story with this dire wraith farmer and his whole history and his history with his wife and having a kid and the history of the town. It was a little bit more long-winded than I probably would have liked it to been, but overall it was still a decent story, and I'm definitely I don't know if you guys are, but I'm a Ram fan. I enjoyed a lot of those issues when back in the 80s when they were coming out, so it was fun to kind of dip my toe back into it.
I have not read hardly any Ram, so
no.
Yeah.
Hearing
that story and the whole thing, it makes me want to dive into some Ram now.
Ram is a lot. Now, the only thing with Ram is that you're not going to be able to get it digitally.
Yeah.
Because he's I think either Mattel or Hasbro toy. Yeah. That was licensed to Marvel at the time, and they put him, you know, right in with the Marvel Universe. Yeah. So, yeah, I think the only way to really get a hold of them are actual copies.
Well, I will be hunting some down.
But you can usually find the majority of them are pretty inexpensive. My database is telling me that issue number one is $34. I do not know where you would need to go to find a $34 issue. I mean, my number one issue, I literally got in a 50-cent / dollar bin. Now, it wasn't like in the past couple of years, but I can't imagine it's gone up to $34.
Right.
Yeah, that seems a little high.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I've only read a little bit of a couple issues of ROM, maybe, and I didn't read any as a kid. I don't know whatever happened across a couple issues in a bin or something like that and checked them out. I generally like superhero comics from the 80s, and so the style is appealing to me, but the way that's kind of not, it sort of steps outside of the normal cape superhero kind of stuff is kind of fun.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because just recently I had read, what was it called? Oh, it's a hardcover book called The League of Regrettable Superheroes. Mm-hmm. And do you know about this, Ronnie?
Yeah.
So, Chris, are you familiar with that book?
I think I've just seen you talking about it, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, all it is it goes Golden Age, Silver Age, and Modern Age, just kind of ridiculous superheroes that were invented, whether they were a little bit more popular, less popular. Like, I would say, especially the older ones, the majority of them, like, might have had a handful of, like, less than a dozen appearances before they disappeared and never were heard from again. Yeah. And in some of the, I mean, a lot of the cases, it's just bizarre that anyone even came up with some of the ideas. Other of them are, like Dollman was in there. Like, so if you're, you know, a comic book fan, it's chances are you know Dollman from the Freedom Fighters and stuff like that. But so it's not like you, but it was still, I mean, when you think about it, he's a little man that is as big as a doll. But Ron was in there and I was surprised, but it was more of a case that it was just a kind of an odd thing. And his point was that the toy itself was a horrible failure, but the comic book ended up not being a failure. And actually ran for 75 issues. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those rare cases where the original material fell flat on its face, but something that was inspired by it actually had legs. And I mean, ROM literally was a standalone toy. There was nothing else with, like, no other line of toys with ROM. It was one little weird looking spaceman. So everything else that Bill Mantlow did was all his creation, you know, the dire wraiths and everything else. Yeah. So, you know, it definitely was very, very interesting.
Yeah, I think that they've been able, Marvel's for that reason, been able to pull dire wraiths and other stuff into later comics, but just not ROM himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is too bad. I would love for them to get, like, the license back and kind of do something with them. I was excited when, who was it? Was it IDW that just had them? I was excited when they came out with that because, you know, I mean, just for nostalgia, and I picked it up and I didn't really love it. I mean, I think it's kind of hard when you can only use a little bit of what Marvel did. So it can't be the same, obviously. It wasn't what I was looking for, really, and it only lasted, I think, 13 issues. It's canceled.
It's too bad, really.
Yeah. Cool. Chris, you got something?
I got one more thing. So you guys probably saw lots of people posting stuff that they picked up if they have Ollie's Bargain Outlet.
Including you.
Including me. I mostly picked up the Showcase Presents volumes that they had for either $3 or $4, depending on the size of them, and I got quite a few, and so I thought I better crack one of them open, and I grabbed the actually alphabetically the first one. It wasn't really for that reason, but maybe it was just the orange color that was calling out to me, but I grabbed Aquaman Volume 1. And I'll talk about the first three stories because they're from Adventure Comics, so they're, I think, around 7 pages each. So they're the They're the Aquaman stories from Adventure Comics issues 278, 279, and 280. I'm on the wrong page. 260, 261, 262. And they have the credit of Robert Bernstein for the writer of the first one, and then it's unknown who wrote the next two, but it seems plausible that it would be him as well. I mean, he ends up, they have a credit for him on later ones. But the artist they know is Ramona Fraiden. So the first story is kind of an appropriate one for the first story in the volume. It's called How Aquaman Got His Powers. And as was kind of the habit at the time, they have a tease image as the first panel of the story. And this one's kind of an amusing one to me because it's a tank of water that little Arthur is submerged in with three giant swordfish. And his father is on the outside, compelling him to control the fish. Make them obey you or you'll never become king of the sea. And this poor kid is holding his hand up like in a futile attempt to ward off these swordfish that are coming after him. Seems like pretty rough parenting there, but
yeah, a little bit.
But so the context of the story though is Aquaman comes across a submarine that's firing atomic depth charges, and so he sees the atomic warheads underground, and he with the help of some whales stops them from submerging all the way and exploding. And then he goes up to the submarine and confronts them. He talks to the commander, and he says, "Look, I need to request that you do this elsewhere. They're basically testing the depth charges." And the commander says, "Well, we chose this area on purpose. Like, you know, we've blah blah blah. There's lots of reasons that they have for doing it there." And so Aquaman takes him to the side and he says, "I really have to insist that you do this elsewhere, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you a story of how I got my powers." And he's like, "Oh wow, you know, nobody knows your secrets and you're going to tell me." So Aquaman goes on to tell his story. A lot of it's, you know, familiar to comic fans. His father was in a lighthouse. He sees a woman on a raft in a storm, rescues her. Her name's Atlanta, and she doesn't tell him anything about where she's from. But they end up, you know, falling in love and having a kid together. And then there's scenes of Aquaman growing up. They discover, you know, that even as a baby, he can swim faster than his father. And at one point, they don't know where he's at, and his father finds him on the bottom of the sea playing with a turtle. And like the shark comes up to him, and the shark doesn't, you know, he just pets the shark and stuff. So, and then eventually, his mom reveals that she's from Atlantis and that it sank to the sea, and she was exiled because she was curious about Earth, and she dies. And Arthur's still a kid, and then we have the scene with the swordfish, and fortunately for all involved, Arthur does manage to control the swordfish with his telepathy. He continues to grow up. His father has him study a lot about the sea to supplant, you know, to well, to go with his powers, basically, to help. In addition to his powers, he studies and learns a lot about the sea. And so the commander eventually says, well, you know, that's all well and good. You know, I'm flattered that you shared all that with me, but what does any of this have to do with my atomic depth bomb tests? And so he whispers something to the commander, and after that, the commander's all on board. He says, "I'll keep your secret safe, and we will move far away from these waters to conduct our tests." And in the last panel, it reveals that as Aquaman swims underwater, that Atlantis was below them. So he was protecting his mother's home, but it doesn't look like he's all that far away from it, but he apparently, from his thoughts, has not yet visited it. so it's not clear why not, but it was a fun little story, but with all three of these stories, I think, like, the highlight is probably the highlight's definitely the art, the Ramona Freyden art. And the stories are okay. They're amusing short stories, but the art is definitely the highlight. The second story is called Aquaman Duels the Animal Master, and long story short, I mean, this is setting up the scenario where the King of the Seas battles somebody who has control over animals, and it's this guy named Gustav who is with the circus and has control over, you know, is a like a lion tamer, tiger tamer kind of guy, and he goes to crime, and Aquaman stops him initially from making off with all of the money that the circus had raised for this charity, and when Aquaman's taking him out, a storm arrives, and Aquaman thinks that this Gustav is killed, but Gustav actually ends up stranded on an island where there happen to be lots of wild animals, and he over time trains them and has control over them, and he then to get revenge against Aquaman, he sends out all these SOSs in bottles, knowing that Aquaman will find out about him when his fish friends bring him these SOSs. So Aquaman goes to the island, and it's pretty much the rest of the story is a battle between the two of them, one using animals like a gorilla and an elephant, and Aquaman using his aquatic eels and swordfish, and he uses an octopus to tie up a lion, and it's that kind of thing. But ultimately, what is Gustav's undoing is that he goes after Aquaman with a water buffalo, and
as you would,
right? Of course. I mean, that's your trump. You've already used a gorilla, an elephant, and a lion. Obviously, your trump card is the water buffalo.
Yep.
And unfortunately, the water buffalo doesn't do what Gustav wants it to do. It listens to Aquaman instead, because, as Aquaman says, my authority over that buffalo overrides yours, because he's a water buffalo.
Oh, because the water's in his name.
And so even if the word, there's an aquatic noun in your name, Aquaman has power over you. So,
makes sense, right?
Yeah. And then, believe it or not, the next and final story I'll cover is probably even sillier than that. It's called the Undersea Hospital, and it's about Aquaman realizing when his buddy, the octopus Topo, has a sprained tentacle, and he binds it for him, and he realizes that, you know, there are probably a lot of of the creatures that are a part of his domain that need medical assistance. So he opens up an undersea hospital complete with like a sign that says and he is basically the doctor that's and it's interesting because he doesn't even like he even uses undersea creatures as his tools. So like there's a shark that has a bad tooth and he uses the claws of a lobster to extract it. And there's a turtle whose head is stuck inside its shell and he uses a swordfish to pull the turtle's head out. So it's really interesting, like the different solutions. Like he wraps an eel in a sheet of rubber because it can't control its electrical shocks, and there's a whale with a fever, so it's shooting steam out of its spout. And so he like brings some ice in from a glacier to cool it off and stuff. Well, the twist is that then he takes a break from being a doctor, and he goes to stop some pirates from stealing a telescope lens from a floating astronomer's observatory. He creates a whirlpool to trap them, and it seems like he's successful. And then at the last minute, one of the pirates opens fire on him and actually shoots him up. Naturally, they don't show any like bullet holes or any blood or anything like that, but he is shot full of bullets and starts sinking down into the water. So the twist being that it's the sea creature's turn to be the doctor's, and so they take him, and some lantern fish create a light for the operating room, electric eels shock him for the anesthetic, octopi squeeze his legs with all of his limbs with their tentacles to make tourniquets, and then swordfishes use, you know, their pointy ends, beaks, or whatever. I don't know, that's not what they're called, but that's how they probe for the and extract the bullets, and then the they probe for them, and then suckerfish suck out the slugs, and jellyfish apply healing balm to him, they use some sailcloth from shipwrecks and make bandages for him, and then just lay him out on top of a whale to recover, and eventually he wakes up and realizes that the animal saved his life. So I mean, it's a really silly story, but then as I was reading, I was realizing like you could kind of write this story if in a modern setting just by making everything more plausible, like as far as like Aquaman discovering like a need for sea creatures to be attended to, and not making an undersea hospital, but getting involved in establishing some kind of like marine life organization or something like that, you know, and having that threatened, and then the marine life organization having to save Aquaman's life or something like that. So, I mean,
yeah,
the tone of it's really silly, but I don't know. I find reading DC stuff from this era though really entertaining for how little it's concerned with you know, the normal things that people. The plausibility type thing people would you know care about today. You know, it doesn't have to make as much sense, so the writer's imaginations tend to go pretty wild,
and it doesn't have to be like a life and death like world shattering situation.
Right So
interesting,
pretty fun.
That's cool, of a cool karma type story though.
Yeah I liked it. It was a fun twist. And I mean, it's one of the things that sort of ended up, I don't know, people thinking that's kind of cheesy about Aquaman, but I like in these old stories how frequently he uses his powers of like telepathy with the fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real strong. They used it so much and such a strong hook that it ended up kind of becoming like a cliche or just like a stereotype for him. But it's fun,
right?
So, all right. I don't know, Ronnie, if you had anything else that you wanted to cover. Or...
Nope. I do have a caveat though. When I was talking to the Lone Ranger and I said that I had the exclusive cover from the database that I couldn't remember the name of. Mm-hmm. It's Comic Collector Live.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I remember that now.
Because they were just starting and popular back then, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, I used them for a while, actually.
Yeah.
Don't anymore, but.
Yeah, same.
What, do you use anything? Well, Ronnie, how many physical copies are you buying these days?
Physical?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think because it varies. Like here lately, Detective and Batman, and then Amazing Spider-Man are officially the floppy ones that I'm getting. Mm. I was getting all of Valiant floppy and all of Aftershock floppy,
mm-hmm.
but those started to dwindle down too. So
yeah.
So no, now
I heard Valiant went out of business. Is that true?
When we're not recording, I can talk about it, but it's pretty much going downhill, I think.
Yeah, I do so.
It sure seems like it from the outside without knowing anything whatsoever besides just the public information.
Yeah, right.
But, it doesn't look good anyways.
Yeah.
Which is too bad.
Definitely.
All right, well, Rob, I think are you all set, or that's all I got.
I'll just go. I have one, but I'm just going to do it really, really fast, just because I did read it this morning. I'll just give the broad beat of it. First, I want to ask. It's Exiles number one, the first issue. Hmm. Did you read Exiles at all?
I briefly did. I mean, I didn't read the whole like run, but
mm-hmm.
here or there, I did.
Yeah, I never read any Exiles at all, so I just...
Yeah,
I was looking for something.
Some of it, I think, like when Judd Winnick was... I don't know how long he was writing it, but back in that era when I got back into comics and I was trying a little bit of everything, I remember trying that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of knew what the premise of it was, but I didn't know a lot, about him, aside from Blink from... Age of Apocalypse.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I decided to read it today, and I'm just scrolling through all these pages because there is not one credit thing on any of these pages, so I have no idea who did any of this work, which is very strange. But anyhow, Exiles number one just basically shows in turn each member of the group just. Appearing in this like deserted landscape.
Watch out!
Did you guys hear that screaming?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
So anyhow, like first Blink, and then one after the other, they just start popping out of nowhere on this like desert landscape. So you get to be introduced to each character one at a time: Blink, Nocturne, Morph. Who's next? I don't know what they call if it's a Warbird or if it's something else. But anyhow, it's John Proudstar, not James Proudstar from another. Anyhow, they're all from different realities. There's Mimic, and there's a guy called Magus. So they all are from a different reality. They're brought together in this landscape, and they meet each other, and then after you're introduced to each character one by one as they appear, then it just briefly goes in the next like three pages each character's kind of history slash what their reality is. Like Nocturne is in one reality is Nightcrawler's daughter, and she was part of an X-Men team, and then it goes he is called Thunderbird. Thunderbird's history, and he was taken over by and made what do they call those? The guys from that Apocalypse picks.
Horseman.
Yeah, he was made into one of them, and he was able to buck off that programming and so on and so forth. So it just goes into them one at a time. And then it turns out, so their missions are going to be, they have to prevent some things that are happening in each one of their realities that they're saying, like, something has changed, where Blink was never born, and each one of the others, there's just something that had happened that they need to now go back and go through all these realities to try to correct. So their first mission is to go to another reality to find like a great teacher. So they assume that that's Professor X. They land in this reality and they find out that there's absolutely no superheroes or anything for 50 years. They imprison or kill anyone that has any types of superpowers. So they find out, they hack into a computer and find out that Professor X, Charles Xavier, is alive, and he's being held in a detention center. So they end up breaking into the detention center after fighting off a lot of troops, and they rescue Professor X. But he's not a professor in this reality. He's just Charles Xavier, but he has the same powers. And they rescue him, get him out of there. And once he realizes that he's free, they're like, okay, let's explain to you what's going on and what we need you for. And he's like, I'm in your heads. I know exactly what's going on. And he knocks them all unconscious. And because in his reality, he's been imprisoned all of these years and never given a chance to do anything. And basically, you know, he's saying that I see your idea of mutants and humans living together peacefully, that's ridiculous. I'm going to make sure we assume our place in the world, and it's going to begin with the end of humanity. And that's the end of the issue. So he's set up to be, you know, obviously a villain. It was okay. I've never read any Exiles before. I don't have any particular burning desire to keep reading it, to be honest with you. But overall, it was an okay starting off point. I know that there's a few other people that are pretty interested in that series and in Blink specifically, but you know, I thought it was all right, but I'm not going to be pursuing it anytime soon, I don't think.
Yeah, I think part of the appeal of it was that they go to different worlds and the different worlds are like different takes on the Marvel Universe, or you know, it's almost like a tour through different what ifs and stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of like, the impression that I'm getting as well.
It was like Elseworlds, but could be in canon because they were time traveling into them.
Yeah. I took a look at. I was looking at issue one on Marvel Unlimited while you were talking about it. Definitely looks like Mike McCone art. Which I see he worked on some of the later issues with Calafiori, so maybe he's just an anchor, but
oh, you're right, it is Mike McCone. I'm looking in my database, and so you're absolutely right, and Judd Winnick is the writer.
Yeah, I was going to say, he must be the writer, because the funny thing is that there's also no creative team listed on Marvel Unlimited for number one.
But, yeah, nothing. No, that's where I was looking, was Marvel Unlimited.
Okay, I thought maybe you were looking at the physical, but yeah.
Judd Winnick, I'm like, there's nothing there.
Yeah. Judd Winnick writes the next 25 issues and then comes back again for a few more, so
yeah.
Seems like a pretty safe bet that he was a writer. But
I mean, it must have been a decently popular book. This volume lasted 100 issues, and then they, you know, came back for more, and you know, mm-hmm. future follow-up series. Obviously didn't last as long, but still.
And it's coming back again.
And it's coming back again, right?
Oh, okay.
So
Yeah, I remember there being a fair amount of buzz around it. Like I said, I read a handful of issues that Winnick wrote, and it was kind of entertaining. I mean, they'd have characters come and go too, because they were alternate versions of, you know, obscure characters to begin with, and like, so it was a little more possible that a character could be killed than you normally would have in a
sure.
superhero. Mm-hmm. So there was some
that makes
that
sense.
Were fun about it, but
yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that'll wrap us up for this time, Ronnie. It was really cool getting to talk to you and having you on the show with us. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you for coming, Ronnie.
Thanks for inviting me. I listen to you guys all the time. So.
Oh, okay, awesome. That's awesome.
Well, you're definitely welcome back anytime that you're interested. So, yeah, it's awesome having actually being able to talk to you.
Yeah.
First time.
Yeah.
So, you kind of spelled your Twitter out earlier, but if you want to mention that again, and any other like contact info or anything else you want to share with people.
Yep, I am at RonBar316 on Twitter, and then I take care of most of the show Twitter handles that I do. So,
cool. So yeah, check out Ronnie's shows on the Nerdy Legion, and you can tweet me at MythMakingETC. Rob is at Rob Krieger.
And, very original. That's very original.
Rob, yeah, I'm Krieger. Not. I've always wondered how you came up with that one, but
it was just it was just a random generator.
Yeah. Yeah, you could have done like at rhymes with Seeger.
Yeah, I could have. I probably should have until recently, but yeah. I think Mike's got it now. Once you told him the Seeger, he was good to go.
Yeah, it still helps me sometime. Like, don't say it wrong. It rhymes with Seeger. What else? Geek Brunch. podcast.com. Like us on Facebook. Mike always does this, so I don't remember what Mike says. I think that's pretty much it. You can Mike's email, Mike's Mike at Mike Myers Brunch, and Comic M at what is the
what are you trying to get?
His email. It's Comic Book Noise, yeah. Comic M at Comic Book Noise, I think, is... I don't know. People don't email people. They just...
Yeah, I don't know what
who cares? Nobody's going to email anyway, so... yeah, I guess
doesn't he have one, Mike at comicbooknoise.com?
Yeah, I think it might be... I think it's Mike. Comic M is his name on some other things.
Yeah.
Or that's what he used on forums and stuff. Who cares? He wasn't even on this episode, so who cares? All right. All right, well, thanks again, guys. I think that'll do it for this episode, and you guys have a wonderful Sunday.
Yeah, you too.
You too.
All right.
Thank you very much, guys.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.